Okay, good morning, class.
This is Bio 231, Wednesday, November 4th. And we're going to finish up endocrine chapter and start with the heart chapter in just a second after we do some comments on endocrinology. And I do have an announcement. This week was Transfer Center Appreciation Week. And so the Transfer Center is really good. If you're going to transfer onto another college, help you with how do you write letters and fill out applications and all that kind of stuff. And so, of course, that's something that we all promote here because I and all the other instructors realize that this is not the class, the last class you're going to be taking. You're going to be taking other classes at other colleges and other places. So we're supposed to wear a little tag of what our alma mater is. And so I finally got one, and I'm going to wear it just like that. So you can see where one of the colleges I graduated from. There's some that don't have stickers or mascots, so I won't wear those. Okay, all right, so here's the sign-in sheet. Go ahead, sign it, pass it down, please. And I get to turn some lights off now. Okay, really good. All right, let's check out the schedule first. And the schedule is right here. All right, obviously somebody must have questions that I missed. Who's got questions? Anybody have any questions? No? Okay, well don't bug the neighbors next to you if you're talking, okay? All right, let's take a look at the schedule. So we said today's the 4th. Indeed, we're going to get into heart. We've got a couple of lectures on heart. Lab practicums are almost over this week. There are no lecture exams. The next lecture exam, however, will be on November 16th. Let's find out when that is. So today is the 4th. 1 week from today is the 11th, and there is no class. It's a holiday, Veterans Holiday. Don't know why it's in the middle of the week, but it is. And then the Monday after that is your next lecture exam on chapters 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. We're going to start the heart today, but that is not on this upcoming test. It's on the last test. So heart is on the 4th test, and we're going to take the 3rd one first. All right, so endocrinology is the last bit of material for that test that's coming up. And, you know, I just noticed that I could have had that test scheduled instead of on the 16th. I could have moved it up to the 9th instead. I don't know why there's such a big gap right there. I made a mistake. But nonetheless, I can offer you that option. Do you want to take the test on the 9th or the 16th? The 16th? Okay, but don't get behind in those other chapters, right, that you're going to take on December 9th. That's the last day of class. That's a Wednesday. And those are the chapters on it. But the reason why I mention it is because folks that have a Wednesday lab will have a lecture exam and a practicum on the same day, just like the Monday group did. All right, and you can talk to somebody in the Monday group. Some people thought it was helpful. Some people thought it was too much or just about right. So talk to them. But nonetheless, be prepared. Don't get caught short on time. All right, that's the schedule. Anybody have a question on the schedule? We're pretty good. All right, I'll put it away. Let's review a couple things. I do have the words flight up. A couple things via endocrinology. What's a hormone? Who can tell me something about a hormone? What is a hormone? I can't hardly see anybody out there, but I know you're there. Who knows what a hormone is? Okay, too much information at one time. What kind of gland secretes a hormone? Endocrine gland. All right, so a hormone is secreted by an endocrine gland. And how does it get around everywhere in the body? Yeah, so a hormone is secreted by an endocrine gland that enters the circulatory system and it travels everywhere in your body, but it only affects certain kinds of tissues. What do those tissues have to have? A receptor. They have to have a receptor for that hormone, right? And a tissue that has a receptor for that particular signal has a name. Does anybody know what that name is for a tissue that can be controlled by a hormone from some distant location in your body? It's called a target tissue, right? So that's another way of asking a question. What does a target tissue have that other tissues do not? It has a receptor. Yeah, it has a receptor, okay? And then once that hormone binds to the receptor, this is the last part of what a hormone does, It elicits a specific response, or it changes the physiology of the target tissue. So the endocrine gland is controlling the physiology of some distant target tissue, as long as it has a receptor. All right, so don't forget, endocrine gland is a ductless gland because it uses the circulatory system to be delivered wherever it needs to go. All right, one of the more complicated endocrine glands that we looked at was the pituitary gland, and there are some structures that you definitely have to know about, and I think it's maybe first time you hear it, it seems really strange because in the name is not pituitary gland. It is the alternate name for pituitary gland, and does anybody have any recollection of what that alternative name for pituitary gland is? Yeah, hypo, right? Because it's underneath the hypothalamus, which is below the thalamus. Hypophysis. Hypophysis is another name for pituitary gland. All right, and so the hypophysis or pituitary gland has two main parts to it. There's an anterior and a posterior part. The anterior part is glandular tissue. The posterior part is nervous tissue. All right, so they secrete different kinds of hormones. The posterior part, nervous tissue, only secretes two. So that's pretty easy. You'll be able to remember those. But the anterior pituitary secretes a number of them, five or six, depending on how you want to count them. And these are what we call trophic hormones. They get secreted into the blood, go to another endocrine gland, and causes that endocrine gland to grow or not to regress and also to secrete that particular hormone. So, for instance, thyroid stimulating hormone is a trophic hormone that goes through the thyroid gland, and it maintains the size and shape of the thyroid gland. Without TSH, the thyroid gland is going to atrophy. It's going to get very small. Thyroid stimulating hormone also tells the thyroid gland not only to grow, maintain itself, but to secrete thyroid hormone, right? All right, so trophic hormones do that. All right, so how does the hypothalamus control the pituitary? Well, it depends if it's anterior or posterior. If it's the anterior pituitary, there are neurohormones secreted by the hypothalamus that take a vascular route. They get picked up by a capillary, and then that capillary coalesces into a couple of little blood vessels that we call portal blood vessels, which takes it to another capillary system in the anterior pituitary. Those blood vessels between the hypothalamus and anterior pituitary are real special. There's only a couple of these types of blood vessels in your body, these portal vessels, and you should know the specific name for these portal vessels. They're called the hypophyseal portal veins. Hypophyseal portal veins, because they're going to the hypophysis. A portal blood vessel, we're going to look at what the definition of a portal blood vessel is in a couple of chapters, right? So you just got to take my word for that. All right, the posterior pituitary. Oh, look, that must be an exam figure. The posterior pituitary, right? We see that there are myelinated axons that go through the pituitary stalk. What's another name for pituitary stalk? Infundibulum, that's in your lab book. And there's even another name that I have fun with. I call it a peduncolito, right? Just a little tiny peduncle, because a peduncle is a bridge between major parts of the brain, and the posterior pituitary really is nervous tissue. Well, these myelinated axons go into the posterior pituitary, and instead of releasing a neurotransmitter, they release a substance that gets picked up by the blood, transferred to a distant location where it binds to a receptor and it elicits a specific response. So those things sound like hormones, right? So we would like to consider these things neurohormones because they're secreted by a neuron. Here are the two examples, oxytocin and ADH. All right, so this you could consider central nervous system, right? And these nuclei here are nerve cell bodies and dendrites that are not myelinated, so they look gray. But these axons are myelinated. They look white. So what do we call white matter in the central nervous system? And what do we call it in the peripheral nervous system? White matter, I heard it someplace. White matter in the central nervous system is a tract. White matter in the peripheral nervous system is just called a nerve, right? So nerve and tract, pretty much the same thing, except one's in the PNS, the other is in the CNS. So here is a tract, and you should know the name of that tract. It's the hypothalamic hypophyseal tract. So hypothalamus, where it originates, hypophysis is where it goes, which is the posterior pituitary. And it's a tract because it's a group of myelinated axons. All right, so that's just a little review of the pituitary gland. And here's that optic chiasma that you're kind of familiar with. Right, that's an easy landmark to find. So the pituitary is just posterior to that, or the infundibulum is just posterior to that. It's kind of nestled between the optic chiasma and the structure right here. All right, so where do I have the cursor hovering? It's not labeled on this diagram, but it's mammillary body. That's right, mammillary body. So the infundibulum is between the optic chiasma and mammillary body when you look for it in lab. All right, who's got some questions regarding the pituitary gland? Anyway, anybody? We're pretty good. All right. Well, I think then we're going to carry on with the pancreas. All right, the pancreas. Where the heck is the pancreas located? Well, I think we have a picture of a whole person right here. Oh, maybe that's an exam figure. All right, so here's the pancreas. Abdominal cavity is right underneath the stomach, which you can't see. Right in front of the kidneys that you can see, above your belly button a little bit. Okay, and it's mostly over on the left-hand side. It's got a thin part that we call the tail. It's got a thicker part that has a head. And it's got a number of different kinds of cells in there. It is part endocrine gland and part exocrine gland. So it does have ducts for the exocrine part of the pancreas. The endocrine part secretes two hormones that regulate blood glucose levels. Right, and the names of those are insulin and glucagon. Where do I have these? Oh, here, glucagon and insulin. All right, so they are in your notes. So the pancreas has a couple different parts to it. There are parts that have follicles, and then there are cells in between the follicles, and we call those islands. All right, so can you see like a circular structure right here with fluid on the inside? That's a follicle. Here's another follicle, another one, okay? And these cells that make up a follicle are called acinar cells. They make the wall up of a follicle. These are the cells that secrete digestive enzymes into a duct. So these are part of the exocrine function. So I don't want to talk about those. But there are cells, like right here, between a follicle on the right, follicle on the left. These are what we call islets. And the guy that first, or woman, I don't even know, who first described these was named Langerhans. So these are the islets of Langerhans, and there's basically two kinds of cells that we see. And maybe you could tell by color, but I have no idea which one is which. There are alpha and beta. Probably the first one that they found and described is the alpha cell. The second one is the beta. And it just so happens that the alpha cell secretes a hormone called glucagon. Glucagon regulates blood glucose levels. And let's start with insulin, though. Insulin comes from the beta cells, which are in these islets as well. And I think probably everybody has a sense or a feel for what insulin does. What does insulin do to blood glucose levels? Increase or decrease? Okay, insulin decreases blood glucose levels because, yeah, I know that seems a little strange. It's really important, but it's a really good thing. Because insulin allows all the cells in your body, or most of them, to take glucose that's in the blood, bring it into the cells, and then those cells can use glucose for their metabolic processes, like making energy, making ATP. So insulin is very important so that cells don't starve to death. Right? Without insulin, glucose is going to get stuck in the blood and can't go anywhere. Right? And so all the cells of somebody's body then are going to starve, which is a terrible thing. So that's why insulin decreases blood glucose, because the rest of your body absorbs it into cells. So insulin you should think of as a passport that glucose needs to enter cells. Without it, glucose can't get into a cell, and then that cell is in real trouble. All right, the second kind, glucagon. Well, if insulin decreases blood glucose, guess what glucagon does? Think of biceps brachii and triceps brachii. Think of pectoralis major and latissimus dorsi. Think of hamstrings and quadriceps. What's the principle between those groups of muscles? They're antagonistic to each other, right? So insulin and glucagon are antagonistic to each other. If insulin decreases blood glucose, glucagon increases blood glucose. And it can do that because we store glucose in a special form in our liver and in some muscle cells, but let's just consider liver mostly. and it's called glycogen. And glycogen is just a big, huge molecule with thousands of glucoses all put together to make one big, huge molecule. So when glucagon is secreted, it tells the liver, right, glucagon, where does glucagon come from? What organ? Okay, pancreas, yeah. So glucagon comes from the pancreas, right? It gets secreted into the blood, goes to a distant target tissue, and that distant target tissue is the liver, right? So that's why I wanted to ask you that question. So, and what does the liver have so that it can actually sense the presence of glucagon? It's got a receptor, right? And when glucagon binds to receptors in the liver breaks down glycogen into glucose and secretes it into the blood. And when it does, what happens to blood glucose levels? They go back to where they should be, okay? All right, so that's the action of insulin and glucagon. And that's really important that we have antagonism there, just as it is important that you have a gas pedal and brake pedal in your car, right? Maintains precise balance and control of blood glucose. If it's not regulated right, then your cells can't function properly. Okay, there's one last thing I wanted to say. I forgot what it was. Might not come back to me. Okay, thymus gland. All right, thymus gland is in the mediastinum. All right, and it's a special place where certain kinds of white blood cells go to mature. We say gain competence so that they can fight infection. And it just so happens those are called T lymphocytes. And you kind of know what a lymphocyte is, right? This is a special kind, a T lymphocyte. It helps fight infection. And it is a contact killer. So when it bumps into a bacteria, it latches onto that bacteria, secretes some compounds, and the bacteria explodes. It lyses the bacteria. And when the bacteria explodes, it can't be infectious anymore. But that T lymphocyte actually has to come in contact. Fortunately, there's a lot of T's and all this stuff. It has to contact a bacteria, right, or maybe a fungus particle or something like that before it can kill it. Another kind of lymphocyte that has nothing to do with the thymus gland is called the B lymphocyte. It doesn't have to touch a bacteria. It secretes chemicals that can, and those are called antibodies, right? But you just have to know about these T cells. Where do T lymphocytes go to gain competence? What organ do T lymphocytes have to go to before they can fight an infection? The thymus gland, yeah. Okay, gonads. I think we all know where gonads are. Maybe I have a picture, maybe not. Let's see. Probably not so much. All right, well, two kinds of gonads, female ovary in the pelvic cavity, male testes in a scrotum, not in the pelvic cavity. We'll find out why that is later on in the class. All right, so these are the primary reproductive organs, and their job is to secrete sex hormones and also produce gametes, and I think I talked about gametes already. All right, so in the male, there are tubes that make sperm. And then there are some cells that are outside of those tubes. And those cells outside of the tubes are called interstitial cells, and they secrete androgens like testosterone. And that produces the secondary male sex characteristics, which are some, anybody have a sense of what a secondary male sex characteristic is? Big muscle, deep voice, heavy bones, a little bit taller compared to females. Okay, more hair, and coarser, and in more locations, that kind of stuff, right? Okay, well, that all sounds well and good. Why are males typically taller than females, at least within a family? And it's not really a given thing, it doesn't have to be exactly that, but typically males are taller because it has to do with bones. Where do bones grow in length from? The epiphyseal plate, right, and the epiphyses. Right? And it just so happens that right at puberty, those epiphyseal plates ossify. They become bone. And then that bone stops growing in length. Right? And it's a well-known fact that females mature more quickly than males. Right? So they stop growing at an earlier age compared to males. Males don't reach puberty until later on in life, which means that their bones continue to grow for another year, year and a half, something like that. So they're typically a little bit taller. All right. Testosterone is the primary androgen, It not only maintains secondary sex characteristics, but it also promotes the formation of sperm that we could call spermatogenesis. All right, in the female, ovaries, same kind of function, produces gametes. These gametes, however, are not sperm. They're called eggs. And ovaries secrete a couple kinds of hormones. In the male, it's only one, testosterone. In the female, two different kinds, estrogen and progesterone. Estrogen maintains female secondary sex characteristics. And progesterone is important because it works on the uterus, and it kind of tells the uterus that it should prepare for pregnancy that might happen at any time, or if somebody is pregnant, it maintains a special lining within the uterus. That's what its job is, progesterone. And does anybody know what that period of time that somebody is pregnant is called? It's called gestation. Yeah, gestation is that period of time when somebody's pregnant. And so that's where they got this term from, right? It is a progestational hormone. Pro means what? It supports. It has a positive influence on gestation, and that hormone has to be present in order for implantation to take place and also to maintain pregnancy. All right, so that's the endocrine chapter and what a hormone is and all that kind of stuff. Anybody have any questions on endocrine? No? Okay. Well, let me put it away and move on to the heart. The heart, the heart, the heart. We'll start off with some really nice, easy stuff first. But I do want to show you this figure right here. All right. And maybe, like right about here, you should draw a heart in. I don't have a picture of a whole person with where the heart is located, right? But that's where we're going to start. So here is a heart, right? That belongs inside the thorax within the mediastinum. And notice that as you go from superior to inferior, did you follow that direction? Superior to inferior, the heart has a bit of an angle to it, right? It angles over to the side. And it angles over to the left side of your body. So that's why we think that the heart is more on your left side than in the middle, but actually it starts in the middle and it kind of migrates over to the left. Right. And it kind of looks like a pyramid or a triangle. And the top of a pyramid is called, does anybody know what the top of a pyramid is called? It's called the apex. So this pointy end of the heart is the apex, and the widest part of the heart, which so happens to be superior, that is the base, right? So here's the base, here's the apex. And I'll show you what's next in a little bit, right? That anterior longitudinal sulcus, I'll show you where that is in just a little while. All right, so not only is the heart angulated, okay, from left to right, and maybe I probably should just show you this, okay? Let's start with the heart straight up and down in somebody's body in their mediastinum, right? So this would be the apex. Here's the base, right? So your heart is not smack in the middle. There's some asymmetry here. As you go from base to apex, which way does it go? To the left. It's angulated that way, like so, right? But as you go from base to apex, it's angulated in another way, too. That's why we say biaxial angulation. It also comes anterior. So the apex of the heart is a lot more anterior compared to the base of the heart. Right, so it's angulated to the left, but it's also angulated anteriorly. And when the heart contracts, it's a really forceful muscle. It just doesn't go contract, contract, but it goes boom, boom. And when it goes boom, okay, angled to the left, angled anterior, the heart actually pounds up against your chest wall. And it's very easy to hear. And as a matter of fact, it's easy to palpate on people right underneath the pectoralis major. Right, it's called a point of maximal impulse, PMI. That's what's in your lecture notes, PMI. Okay, where the apex bounces up against the wall of your thorax. And if somebody is really, really skinny, maybe sick, you can actually see their chest right there bouncing out. Okay, it's not really a healthy condition if you can see it because they're way too thin, but you can see it. So if you want to know where somebody's heart is, that's a nice external reference. You can palpate it, right? You can feel around and then find that point of maximal impulse, and then you know exactly where the heart is. If you want to do an imaging study or put electrodes on somebody to measure their ECG or whatever, so that is handy. Okay. All right, let's look at some membranes around the heart. All right, so here is the heart, pretty much, you know, it's midline, but it moves over to the left. It doesn't move over to the right. So here is the left over here, here's the right. So we're probably looking from underneath the heart. And I see some membranes that surround the heart. There's a membrane called the pericardium. We've talked about that one already. And the pericardium surrounds the heart. The heart is not open to the outside world. And so a membrane that lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world has got a special name. Does anybody remember what that special name is? Oh, look at all these nice pictures of the heart. Okay. It's called a serous membrane. And a membrane that lines a cavity that is open to the outside world, that's called a mucous membrane. Maybe that's coming back to you. Well, so the membrane around the heart is a serous membrane. Serous membrane has got three parts to it. There is a part of that membrane that's right on, so here's the heart, it's right on the surface of the heart. So here is the wall of the heart, this is muscle that's contracting. Here is the membrane that's right on top of it. And it's the pericardial membrane, but we got to also say that it's right on the surface of the heart. This is the visceral pericardium, right? Just like the visceral pleura is right on the surface of the lungs. And then it moves over, right, and folds back on itself. This is what we call the parietal pericardium. So serous membrane's got three parts, the visceral on the organ, the parietal, which is right before you get to the organ, and there is a space between, and it's filled with serous fluid. And we're going to call that the pericardial cavity, right? Or pleural cavity if it's the lungs, or peritoneal cavity if it's around the abdominal or pelvic cavity. All right, pericardial cavity. All right, so let me ask, what kind of fluid is in the pericardial cavity? Serous fluid, yeah, okay. And there shouldn't be very much, just a little bit. It helps protect the heart from shock, from bouncing, slamming itself against other parts of your body, so it acts like a little shock absorber. And if your heart is inflamed or the pericardium is inflamed, fluid builds up in this pericardial cavity with serous fluid, and it can have an infection as well. And that's really dangerous because if we look at a whole picture of a heart right here, as the pericardial cavity fills up with fluid, it compresses the heart. It actually shrinks. It shrinks the size of the heart. And when that happens, blood can't get into it. And if blood can't get into the heart, how much blood can the heart pump? Not as much as it should be, right? So this space should just have a very small size to it. Okay. All right, so if we look across the wall of the heart, I see some membranes. So there are different ways to think of membranes. One was in terms of that serous membrane, and the other is kind of like a bone. Remember the name of the membrane that's on the outside of a bone? Periosteum, yeah, peri meaning on the outside. What's the one on the inside of a bone? Endosteum, right. All right, well, the membranes that are associated with the wall of the heart, okay, the one that lines every single cavity on the inside is called the endocardium. Right, we don't want to say endosteum because it's not bone, endocardium. So anytime you hear that word cardio, cardiac, myocardium, that refers to the heart. Right, so endocardium, membrane on the inside of the heart. Then we have the myocardium, which is the contractile muscle cells. And what kind of muscle is that? Is that skeletal muscle, smooth muscle, or cardiac muscle? It's cardiac muscle, special cardiac muscle. And then the next layer, okay, the most superficial, is what we call the epicardium. So we got epicardium, myocardium, endocardium, if we think of the membranes and the layers within the heart. And it just so happens that that epicardium is, right, part of the serous membrane, which we call the visceral part. So the visceral pericardium is really the same thing as the epicardium, but you just have to change your perspective. Right, epicardium, if you're looking at the thickness of the heart of the wall, but it's called the visceral pericardium if you're thinking about the serous membrane that the whole heart sits in. Okay. All right, one last thing. Here is the parietal part of the serous membrane. The heart needs more support other than just the serous membrane. And the serous membrane is what? The visceral part, serous cavity, the parietal part. And so there is another fibrous capsule that surrounds the heart, and we call that the fibrous pericardium. And it's not part of the serous membrane, but it's a special membrane that holds the heart in position so that it can contract properly, and it doesn't have to be held in position with any kind of bones or anything, because this pericardium, fibrous pericardium, is pretty thick and strong. All right, so those are the membranes around the heart. And I'm going to go back to one of this very first slide. This is a great slide. You should be able to draw this slide out from memory, I think, because it is so cool. All right, so here is the heart. I want to focus in on the heart. And the heart has a number of chambers that fill with blood. And when the heart contracts, those chambers get smaller, and the heart pumps that blood into an artery so that it can travel around your body. So there are a number of chambers, and I want you to know how many chambers there are first before we look at them. How many chambers are there?
Four.
There are four. Nice. All right, there are two superior ones that are almost useless, but they're there. They're called atria. Here is one atria, here is the other one. And when we look at this diagram, this will be like looking at my heart. All right, so where I have the cursor right now, right, relates to this hand that's going up. What side of my body is that? That's your left side, right? So here's the left side of the heart, which means this is the right side of the heart. So here is the right atrium. Here is the left atrium. And then the two chambers down below it are called ventricles. These are very powerful chambers. They're surrounded by powerful muscles. They're a lot thicker than the muscles that make up the atria. And so here is the left ventricle. Here is the right ventricle. All right, so the heart has four chambers, right? That's what I got over here. Four chambers, yeah, okay. All right, well, blood should flow through the heart only in one direction. And there's something that makes sure that that happens. Does anybody know what that special thing is that makes sure that blood only flows in one direction? Because we don't want the heart to pump and then have blood go back to where it was. We want blood to get pumped out of the heart and go in that same direction to the rest of your body, okay? And I think I heard it, it's a valve. Right, so the heart has valves, so that blood only flows in one direction. We're going to call that the antegrade direction. It's not going to flow backwards. Backwards is retrograde. If there's retrograde flow in the heart, that will probably eventually kill the heart. So these valves have to be working properly. So how many chambers does the heart have? Four. How many valves does the heart have? Four. Somebody said four, and I want everybody to say that. Just yell that out, right? So how many chambers does the heart have? Four. How many valves? Four. Okay, you learn the names of the chambers. Now we got to learn the names of the valves. All right, so I see four of them. There's one right here between the right atrium and right ventricle. There's one between the right ventricle and the artery. I see it right here. There's another one on the left side of the heart between the atrium and ventricle, which I see right here. And then here is the fourth one. You can barely see it. That's a valve between the left ventricle and the aorta. Okay? Okay, so those are the four valves. Let me find a better picture of those. Here is an important exam figure. This is also the labeling figure for lab next week. All right, so I see four chambers. Right atrium, right ventricle. Left atrium, left ventricle, and the valves. Here's one between an atrium and a ventricle. These are called atrioventricular valves. Both are atrioventricular valves, but they have special names. On the right side of the heart, we're going to call this the tricuspid valve. If you want to call it the tricuspid atrioventricular valve, that's okay. This is really, really good. And that's because it has three of these flaps. I see one on this illustration, but it's got three. Hence, tricuspid. A cusp is this little leaflet that can open and close. If we look at the other atrioventricular valve, right, on the left side, we're going to call this the bicuspid valve because it doesn't have three cusps, it only has two. Okay, it's got two flaps that come together. All right, and it has another name. It's called mitral valve. And people use bicuspid and mitral in the same sentence, and you just got to get it straight in your mind what valve that is, but it's the atrioventricular valve on the left side of the heart. Okay, and a mitre is a hat that some people wear for very special occasions, like the Pope and cardinals. It's flat, they open it up like that and then stick it on their head. It has that point to it. That's called a mitre. And that's kind of what this valve looks like, right, if you remove it from the heart. All right, so that's two valves, right? Tricuspid, bicuspid. How are you going to remember that the tricuspid is on the right side? There's a little saying. It's really stupid, but I'll tell you, you want to know what it is? Yeah? Okay, well, you try before you buy. Okay? Try before you buy as you read, okay, from as you look at this piece of paper from left to right, that's the direction that you read. Tricuspid is the first one and bicuspid is the second one. All right. Well, I don't hear any groans or claps or nothing. Is anybody there? Okay. So those are the two atrioventricular valves. There are two other valves between ventricles and the arteries that are going to be accepting blood from the heart when it contracts. This blood vessel right here is going to take blood to the lungs. So it's part of the pulmonary circulation. If you want to talk to a doctor about your lungs, you want to talk to a pulmonologist, right? So when you hear pulmonary, that's a term that refers to lungs. Here is a blood vessel that takes blood to the lungs. This is what we call the pulmonary artery. You could call this a pulmonary trunk as well. And so this is the pulmonary valve that is in the pulmonary artery. Here's the aorta. It receives blood from the left ventricle, the other side of the heart. And here is the valve that makes sure that blood, once it gets into the aorta, doesn't slip back into the heart. And this is the, since this is the aorta, this is the aortic valve, named after the arteries. All right, so those are the four valves, tricuspid, bicuspid, pulmonary, aortic. Notice that the valves, there are two basic kinds. There are some that have all of these strings attached to them. Those are the atrioventricular valves. These valves at the base of an artery don't have any of these strings, right? And so these cusps right here have a little bit different shape. It kind of reminded somebody of a moon, actually half of a moon. And so these are called semilunar valves. Pulmonary is a semilunar valve. Aortic is a semilunar valve. The tricuspid and bicuspid are what we call atrioventricular valves. So that's some terminology that we use. Okay, so how many chambers does the heart have? How many valves? Four. Nice. Okay. How many sides does the heart have? Okay, and the answer there is two. Okay? All right, so chambers four, valves four, sides two. Let's go back to that very first slide. How do I get back there? Maybe if I do that, go back. Okay, and that's because you have two circulations in your body. I think you might have one, but you actually have two circulations, and you have a pump for each one of those. The first circulation takes blood from the heart to the to the lungs, okay, and then it goes back to the heart. We call that the pulmonary circulation. I need a drink. A little bit better. Okay, so the first circulation starts in the right ventricle, goes into the pulmonary artery, which takes blood to the lungs, and you probably notice that there's a change in color of these blood vessels. Right? What is the color of this pulmonary artery? Yeah, it's blue. That means that it is relatively low in oxygen. And what does red mean? Relatively high in oxygen. So blood going to the lungs is relatively low. Blood leaving the lungs is relatively high. So what enters the blood in the lungs? Oxygen, right? So that's the purpose of the lungs, is that it restores the oxygen levels in blood so that that oxygen can be delivered to the rest of your body. That is one circulation. That's called pulmonary circulation, and it comes from the right side of the heart. That's the first one. Okay, it comes back from the lungs, nicely oxygenated, back to the left atrium. Left atrium pumps it into the left ventricle, and this big, powerful left ventricle pumps it into the aorta. Right? And once in the aorta, it goes everywhere in your body, your head, your toes, everywhere in between. And so we call that the systemic circulation. So it goes to your body and it delivers oxygen, it gives up oxygen. So in this particular case, the aorta, which is an artery, is red colored, and all of these blood vessels bringing blood back to the heart are blue because they're relatively low in oxygen. All right, so that shows you that the heart has two sides, right and left, because there are two circulations. One really kind of small, which is the pulmonary, one which is large, which is the systemic. But both have to work together to pick up oxygen and then deliver it to your body. Here is a wall between the ventricles. That is called a septum. Remember septum pellucidum, separating the lateral ventricles from each other? Well, the interventricular septum separates the right and left ventricle from each other. There's an interatrial septum, which I can't see on this illustration, that separates the right and left atria. All right, now I see some arrows on this diagram. They're super, super important arrows. And are these arrows bidirectional or only one direction, unidirectional? Unidirectional. And that is because the heart has valves, right? Blood doesn't go backwards. Once blood is in this aorta, can't go back to the left ventricle if it's a normal heart and a normal valve. Okay. These are important because the direction of these arrows will determine whether something is an artery or a vein. An artery or a vein is not determined by the color of the blood vessel. Artery and vein is not determined by the level of oxygenation, only the direction of travel of blood. If blood is flowing away from the heart, we call it an artery. So here is an aorta. I see arrows taking blood away from the heart, so the aorta is what kind of vessel, an artery or a vein? It's an artery because it's taking blood away from the heart. Here is a pulmonary blood vessel. It's taking blood away from the heart. So this is also what? An artery, because it's taking blood away from the heart, even though the aorta and pulmonary artery have different colors. Right? So you can't use color to define what a vessel is, whether it's an artery or a vein. It's only the direction of blood flow. So that's another important reason why we have this illustration right here. Here I see an arrow pointing toward the heart. So if you have a vessel that's taking blood back to the heart, we want to then define that to be a vein, right? Veins bring blood back to the heart. So here is just a systemic vein. Over here is a vessel bringing blood back to the heart from the lungs. Is that an artery or a vein? It's bringing blood back to the heart. It's a vein, right? It's a pulmonary vein. So these veins don't have to have the same state of oxygenation. The pulmonary vein is high in oxygen because why? It just is coming from the lungs where it has picked up oxygen. And it just so happens it's a vein because it's bringing blood back to the heart so that the heart can pump it through the systemic circulation. All right, so don't get tricked by that, right? An artery and a vein only are, the definition is due to the direction of travel, not what it's carrying. All right, so how many chambers does the heart have? Four. How many valves? Four. How many sides? Two. Okay, and how many circulations? Two. And you know the names of the circulations? Pulmonary and systemic. Which one is larger? Which circulation is larger? Can you see that or think of that? The lungs are not drawn to scale of this person here. Right? If we were to draw it to scale, this person would have to be huge, right? It would be off the slide. So the systemic circulation is a lot larger compared to the pulmonary circulation. And if you look at this slide right here, you can even tell. The wall of the left ventricle, okay, the thickness of the wall of the left ventricle, let's compare that with the thickness of the wall of the right ventricle. Can you tell one is thicker than the other? Which one is thicker? The left ventricle is definitely thicker. Even the ones in lab that we look at, you will see that. That will be obvious. All right. So since the wall of the left ventricle is thicker, does that mean the left ventricle is stronger or weaker compared to the right? What happens if you have a muscle and you never use it and it's really weak compared to a muscle that you use all the time? It gets big and hypertrophied. Which one is stronger, the big one or the little one? Yeah, the big one. Right? So the thicker the wall, the stronger the heart is, the more pressure it can build, develop in blood so that blood can travel a longer distance. So the left ventricle is a lot more powerful than the right ventricle, and you can just see that in the wall thickness. All right, so I think we've really kind of covered this, except for one last thing. All right, somebody should tell me what an artery does again. Will I get another sip of something here? What does an artery do? Takes blood away from the heart. What about a vein? Mm-hmm. So we have arteries and veins. We have one more type of blood vessel. And I see it on this illustration. It looks like a network right here. And is labeled capillary. All right? So you have arteries, you have veins, and capillaries. And capillaries are real special. They're specialized to do one job. They're not specialized to bring blood to the heart or take blood away from the heart. These things are really thin, so this is the only place where a substance can enter the blood or leave the blood. That process is what we call exchange. On this slide it says gas exchange, but that's true for everything. That's true for glucose entering or leaving the blood, gas like oxygen entering, leaving, hormones entering or leaving like we just looked at. All right, so capillaries are very special because it allows for what kind of process? Exchange, right. Exchange cannot take place in an artery. Exchange cannot take place in a vein because those blood vessels, the walls are way too thick. So if there's anything in an artery, it's stuck there until it gets to a what? To a capillary, and then it can leave, right? Okay, and that's why CPR rules were redesigned not too long ago. Remember, you had to do pretty much the same number of chest compressions as mouth breathings. Okay, and they changed the CPR regulations now to where you should do more chest compressions compared to breathing. And the reason why that is, right, when you compress somebody's chest, you're actually acting like their heart for them. That's not beating. Right, so blood is starting to flow when you do a chest compression. You don't have to breathe so much because all that oxygen that is in these arteries right here is not going anywhere. Right, when somebody passes out, all of these arteries are oxygenated. What's more important is to get that oxygenated blood to the rest of your body, primarily your brain and your heart. Right? So arteries are loaded with oxygen. That's why chest compressions are more important. And that oxygen is trapped in that artery, can't leave until it gets to a capillary. So people do more chest compressions than breathings to help a person out. Okay. Once you start CPR, should you ever stop? No, you should not stop. Now, I don't know, why is that? Anybody, why shouldn't you stop? Even though the person doesn't look like you're helping the person at all. The reason is because if a person's heart has stopped beating and nobody's doing chest compression, there's no blood flow. So there's no oxygen arriving at the brain. And if there's no blood arriving at the brain, then the brain cannot make ATP. And the brain needs a lot of ATP to stay alive. So if no blood is arriving at the brain, you only have a limited period of time where you can maintain consciousness. ATP is necessary to maintain consciousness. And I can't remember if I mentioned this before in class, right? But I do want you guys to know. How long can you maintain consciousness if blood flow to your brain stops? It is 1 to 2 seconds. And that's about it. And then your brain uses up all that ATP that's there, you lose consciousness, and you pass out. Right? And if blood supply is not restored to the brain after a certain period of time, then the brain dies. And of course, when something dies, it can't come back to life. What period of time can your brain survive in an unconscious state before it dies if it's not getting oxygen? It is, 2 to 3 minutes. So 2 to 3 seconds, you'll lose consciousness. 2 to 3 minutes, right, the brain actually dies. So when you do chest compressions, right, you might get enough oxygen to somebody's brain to keep it from dying, but not enough to where they will wake up and become conscious. Right, so the point of CPR is just to maintain the health of the brain enough to where you can get somebody to the hospital and revive them more completely. So if it doesn't look like you're helping that person because they don't wake up and say, oh, thank you, you should just keep doing it anyway because maybe that brain is alive just enough to where we can bring it back all the way. Okay. All right. So we got four valves. Oh, we talked about the transmural layers already in the heart. Blood flow through the heart. We kind of look at it already. Okay, let's look at this figure right here. Can you give me the name of an artery that is high in oxygen? It relates to this slide over here a little bit. Name of an artery. So what's an artery once again? Takes blood away from the heart. Okay, and if it's high in oxygen, it's going to have a certain color on this particular illustration. It's going to look red. All right, so give me the name of a blood vessel that's red, that's taking blood away from the heart.
Aorta.
The aorta, right here. All right, so here's the aorta and all of its branches. Give me the name of a vein, okay, that is high in oxygen. Is there such a thing? Is there a vein that's high in oxygen? And? Trick question, because there is a very important vein that is high in oxygen. What's a vein once again? Takes blood to the heart, brings blood to the heart. Well, look at this blood vessel right here. It's bringing blood back to the heart. And what color is it? It's red, which means it's high in oxygen. So here is a vein that's high in oxygen, and that is the pulmonary vein. Why is it high in oxygen? Because it's coming from the lungs, because that's where gas exchange takes place. That's where oxygen goes in and CO2 leaves, right? These capillaries right here. So again, you can't tell an artery from a vein by what it's carrying, only the direction of blood flow. What about an artery? Give me the name of an artery that is low in oxygen. Is there ever such a thing? There is such a thing, and it is the pulmonary artery is low in oxygen, and that makes perfect sense because it's going to the lungs to pick up oxygen. If it was high in oxygen, there would be no reason to go to the lungs, right? So the pulmonary artery is pretty much the opposite compared to the, the pulmonary circulation is pretty much opposite compared to the systemic circulation. And I'm going to make that point a lot of times in this class, that pulmonary and systemic circulations are pretty much opposite each other, is a good way to think of it. These veins of the systemic circulation are very big. They're huge, right? And they're called vena cavae. And so there's a superior one and an inferior one, and these just mean big cavernous veins, right? So the vena cava, one is a vena cava, right? They're big and they're systemic veins, so they're relatively low in oxygen and blood is flowing back to the heart. All right, that's a really nice illustration. Who's got a question about any of that kind of stuff? Not so much at the moment. All right. Well, you know what? I want to trace. This is one of your pre-lecture reading assignments. I want to trace a drop of blood through the circulations. And I want you to tell me something about that blood. If it's in an artery, a vein, capillary, and what's happening to that blood. Is it high in oxygen, low, and where exchange takes place. All right, so you should actually be able to do this from memory. And you don't have to do it real fast. Okay. Let's see if I have a marker. Oh, yeah, I got a marker. Okay, so we're going to trace a drop of blood through this illustration right here. But we got to start someplace. Where should we start? Pick a structure where we should start. Where would you want to start? Left side of the heart, right side of the heart? Right side. Where on the right side do you want to start? Capillaries on from the right side of the heart. I'll vote that one down. Okay. Right side of the heart, capillaries means we would start right here. Okay, in the pulmonary circulation. Let's start at maybe a little bit better place. Let's start, how about in the right atrium or right ventricle? Don't care. Right atrium. Let's start in right atrium. All right, so I'm just going to abbreviate that. R-A. Like that, that's where we're going to start. What's the state of blood in the right atrium? Is it high or low in oxygen? It's low. All right, so I'm going to put a down arrow with oxygen. Now, where does that blood go, or what does it travel through from the right atrium? Where does it have to pass through? The tricuspid valve. All right, so tricuspid. And what kind of valve is a tricuspid? It is a atrioventricular, right? Because it's between an atrium and a ventricle. Sometimes we call that AV. Sometimes that's an AV valve. people call AV instead of atrioventricular. All right, what's the state of blood as it passes through the tricuspid valve? High or low, state of oxygen? It's low once again. Okay, stays low. So low O2. All right, after tricuspid, where's the blood at? The right ventricle. We can just call that RV. What's the state of blood in the RV? It is low oxygen. All right. Okay, from the right ventricle, what does it have to pass? It's going to go into an artery, yeah, pulmonary artery, but it's got to pass something first before it gets there. A valve, right? So the pulmonary, and that's a semilunar valve. Pulmonary semilunar valve, what's the state of blood as it passes the pulmonary semilunar valve? Low in oxygen. Nice. All right, after the pulmonary semilunar valve, where does it go? Pulmonary artery. What does pulmonary mean? Lungs. Pulmonary artery, and what's the state of blood in the pulmonary artery? High or low oxygen? An artery with low oxygen? Are you sure? You're sure? That's good. You should be sure. You're right. Pulmonary artery, low in oxygen. Right? It's just what? Blood is leaving the heart. That's all there's to it. Pulmonary artery, then where does it go? Pulmonary artery to the lungs. And let's say the capillaries in particular. Right? So let's say pulmonary capillaries. Does that work? Because what does pulmonary mean? Lungs. Right? Capillary. What is special about a capillary? Exchange. All right. So let's put that on this illustration too. Exchange takes place. And so what does that mean? It means that CO2 does what? Goes out. And what about oxygen? Oxygen goes in. And that process here is what we call exchange. All right, after the pulmonary capillary, what brings blood back to the heart? Pulmonary vein. All right, that's the definition of a vein. And what's the state of oxygen in this vein? High oxygen. Is that true? Can there be a vein with high oxygen? Well, in this particular case, because it's part of the pulmonary circulation, indeed. All right, so now we got high oxygen because exchange has taken place. Right? Pulmonary vein brings blood back to the heart. What part of the heart? We got to go to the other side. We started at the right side. We're going to go back to the left side. And what's that first chamber on the left side? Left atrium. All right, what's the state of oxygen there? High. Okay, so from the left atrium, let's go over here. Where do we go now? We got to get to the ventricle somehow. How do we get there? Pass a valve, and that valve is the bicuspid valve. Bicuspid, right? Mitral, it's got a bunch of names. And it's an AV valve between an atrium and a ventricle. And what's the state of blood as it passes this valve? High in oxygen. All right. Then the blood goes into the left ventricle. What's the state of oxygen? High oxygen. Left ventricle. How does it get into an artery? Passes through the aortic semilunar valve. Aortic semilunar valve, and oxygen there is high. All right, so and then goes into a vessel that's going to carry blood away from the heart. That's an artery. The name of that artery is the aorta. What's the state of oxygen there? Is high. That's right. If it's high, in the left ventricle, high by, as it passes the semilunar valve, it's got to be high in the aorta because it's trapped in there. It can't get out, right? All right, aorta. Then where does blood go to after the aorta? Systemic capillaries. What happens there? Exchange, right. Oh, look at all this nice board I have. Exchange. So what does that mean? What about oxygen? What about CO2? What happens to oxygen? It goes? Oxygen goes out, and CO2 goes in. All right, so that's exchange. And then after the systemic capillary, it's returned back to the heart, so that's got to be a vein, right? And so we could say systemic veins, or you could say vena cava if you want to. What's the state of blood in the systemic veins? It is O2 goes out. It's low in oxygen. Okay, systemic veins. All right, and then from systemic veins, where does it go? I thought I got lost there a second. Where does it go, systemic veins, according to this diagram? Right atrium, right? And that's low in oxygen. Is that where we started? Yeah, oh, well, that's fortunate. Right, same name, same oxygen levels, all that kind of stuff. So that names all the blood vessels, all the valves, chambers of the heart, and everything. So if you have a picture of that in your mind, that's wonderful. Okay, you should, to answer questions. Okay, and for you guys, since you're on some kind of clinical track, you should remember that just like that for the rest of your lives. Okay, because it's that important. Okay, any question on that? So here's that nice figure that shows us all of that kind of stuff. Okay. Coronary circulation. Okay, let's talk about coronary circulation just a little bit. Coronary circulation refers to blood vessels that supply the myocardium itself with blood. All right, and the heart is a muscle that requires oxygen. All right, and so there are vessels that bring oxygen to the heart, and those are arteries. And they're high in oxygen. So what kind of arteries are they? Are they pulmonary or systemic arteries that bring oxygen to the heart? I see some blue and red things right here on the heart. Okay. If it's an artery high in oxygen, what kind of artery does it have to be? Systemic or pulmonary? Okay. Take a look at that. I went to a different slide, but look at that first one I was showing you. All right. You know what? I bet I could. One click. Two clicks. All right, so here's an artery that is high in oxygen. Here is an artery low in oxygen. Which circulation is high in oxygen? Here's pulmonary circulation. Here's an artery is blue. What does that mean? Low in oxygen. Here is an artery that's high in oxygen, and it happens to be the systemic circulation. Right. So the blood vessels that bring oxygen to the brain, I mean to the heart, blood vessels that bring oxygen to the heart are part of the systemic circulation, right? Not pulmonary. If it was pulmonary, it would be bringing relatively low oxygen to the heart. Your heart needs a lot of oxygen. All right, so coronary circulation is part of the systemic circulation. And here is the aorta. That is the first artery of the systemic circulation. There are two blood vessels that leave the aorta way down by its base. There's one that goes to the right side of the heart, and there's one that goes to the left side of the heart. And so the one that goes to the right side is called the right coronary artery. One that goes to the left is the left coronary artery. That's pretty easy to see. Okay, and then it goes into a capillary in the heart. What happens in that capillary of the heart? Exchange. And what kind of exchange? What leaves the blood? Oxygen leaves the blood, goes into the heart, and then what leaves the heart goes into the blood? Carbon dioxide. All right, so this red blood vessel right here is a coronary artery. The blue one is a coronary vein. And so these are colored just like the typical, any typical systemic blood vessel, right? Arteries are red, veins are blue, only in the systemic circulation, opposite compared to the pulmonary circulation. All right, so I see the right one, I see the left one, and I see a branch right here. Maybe can I zoom in? Yeah, I can zoom in a little bit. All right, so here's the aorta. Here is the right coronary artery. There is the left one that goes behind the, this is the pulmonary trunk, goes to right here, and then it splits into two. You see that split after I zoomed in? Okay. Oh, nice wheel. This one that travels in a sulcus between an atrium and a ventricle, we call this the circumflex artery. The one that goes down the anterior side of the heart, right, is in a sulcus, and that sulcus just happens to be right along the line of that septum, the interventricular septum. And so sometimes this is called the anterior interventricular artery. Where is it named? Anterior interventricular artery. It also has another name, much more common name. It's also called the left anterior descending, right? Because it's on the left side of the heart, it's on the anterior side, and it descends down toward the apex of the heart. And that's what most people call it, left anterior descending. And they don't say all that, they would just abbreviate it and call it the LAD. This is a blood vessel that acquires most of the damage in somebody's heart. So when you're having a bypass, or some kind of angioplasty, it's usually of this LAD, which is what? The left anterior descending blood vessel. Okay, and it can be in multiple locations. All right, so there's a sulcus right on top of that interventricular septum, and that sulcus, right, is filled with fat. It's filled with these coronary arteries and veins. And because there is fat in that depression, when you look at the heart muscle itself, which is going to be red, a dark color, and what color is fat in lab? Kind of yellow, whitish, right? Whitish, very light color. It's very easy to see. The contrast is great. You'll be able to see this white stripe compared to the red background. So this is a very nice, easy landmark to know. And we call this the anterior longitudinal sulcus. So there's three things that you got to know about the heart. Okay, you got to know where is the apex. It's the pointy end. Where is the base? The widest part. And then you want to find this anterior longitudinal sulcus, which is right here, nice and white. And then you know everything about the heart. You know what's on the left, what's on the right, what's on the top, what's on the bottom, what's in the front, and what's in the back. So those three things I'll certainly point out and mention in lab a couple times, and that's going to be really important for that practicum coming up. Numerous times I've had a student during a practicum just kind of raise their hand and they would say, oh, you know, I was really familiar with the heart. I knew everything about it, all the valves, all the little muscles, all that kind of stuff. But when I look at this thing, all of a sudden it's turned into a blob. And I go, I understand. Just answer three questions for me. Don't say the answers out loud, but I'm going to ask you three questions. It's okay if the rest of the class hears it. I say, okay, you know where the apex is? And they say, yeah. Okay. I go, well, you know where the base is? And they go, oh, yeah. Okay. And I go, where is that anterior longitudinal sulcus? And then all of a sudden they say, oh, they see it. They see the whole heart, right? So just those three things will just zoom you right into all the structures in the heart, those three things. What are those three things? Apex, base, anterior longitudinal sulcus. All right, so give yourself maybe about a week and that will make really nice, perfect sense. Okay. All right, so coronary circulation are just systemic arteries and veins that supply oxygen to the heart. Okay, so I'm going to stop right there unless somebody has some questions. Sign-in sheet is going around. And there's still a practicum yet this afternoon. The rest of you guys have a nice weekend.